This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Marty Gross picked up the guitar over 70 years ago, and he hasn't put it down since. Today he's recognized as one of the foremost chord specialists in jazz rhythm guitars, but what truly sets Marty apart is his stage presence.
Horace Gerlach, a name to conjure with. He wrote two songs that were wonderful, recorded by Louis Armstrong, which I will do in sequence, and one song that was not so wonderful that made him a lot of money. And that was Daddy's Little Girl, which is usually sung in joints by fathers who have not paid any child support for several years and are getting maudlin about the children they left behind.
Daddy's Little Girl.
Marty Gross uses his sense of humor to connect with audiences, distinguishing him from most jazz guitarists who are famously subdued. He's spending this week in residence at Duke University performing songs and sharing stories from his long career in music, and joins me now in the studio. Marty Gross, welcome to State of Things. So good to have you here.
Thank you.
You are a renowned jazz guitarist, but I understand that the guitar was not your first instrument. In fact, it was the ukulele.
Correct. I was a dud, a ukulele dud. That was when I was about 8 years old, and I was going to public school, PS 98, in Douglaston, New York, and which is in Long Island. And one day they made an announcement: anybody with a musical instrument, bring it to school and bring your lunch. And I lived close enough to the school so I could walk home for lunch, but I brought my lunch that day, what was I, 8 years old, 9 years old, or something like that. And I the only instrument we had around was an old ukulele that my father had picked up someplace, and it was with friction tuning pegs and gut strings and stuff like that. And the other kids brought trombones, violins, whatever was around the house, accordions. A couple of kids played piano. It was the drums. So you can imagine there's about 15 of these kids in a schoolroom, and one teacher was during the Depression, and he was probably delighted to have the job, to have a salary going around. Can't have been a very happy job for him to teach these kids something about music, the rudiments of music. So there was a girl playing banging on the piano. Here's another guy playing on the trombone, you know. Another one out of tune fiddle, which is very easy to do, to play the violin out of tune, and so forth. All this guy playing on the drums and stuff. And here I am with this uke. You know, where are you going to go with that, with all that din? And so the teacher came by, and he friction tuning pegs. That's the kind of just stuck into the, you know, instrument,
and pretty hard to hold the tune.
Yeah,
is the point.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. And he says, I said, you know, I'm looking at this thing. I've never even seen a uke before. I didn't even know we had one. It was in the attic, and so I just put my fingers on it, and he said, okay, play this. And now with your right hand, go plunky, 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 plunky. So I did the plunky, plunky, plunky for 20 minutes. And he came back and said, okay, now put your fingers here and go plunky, plunky, plunky. And that was the end of the, that with plus time out for eating my sandwich. That was the music lesson. That went on about three or four times. And my mother said, you know, this is not happening.
Yeah. Well, then how did you come to the guitar?
I don't know. Something, it must have stuck in my head because, young people get involved with music, aside from those who studied classical music and gone into it earlier, but when young pimply-faced, idiotic kids, 13 and 14, get involved with music, it has to do with puberty. It's always bound up with that. That's when all of a sudden the junior wants to have a set of drums and wants to get a guitar and bugs his parents to death and so forth. I didn't bug my parents to death. I saved my shekels and bought my own guitar. I was going to do this on the sly. I Oh, what got me going was, it was of course the era, the swing era.
Oh yeah.
Big bands were it's all you heard. Glenn Miller was In the Mood was played all over the place. Benny Goodman's this and da da da. Even Kay Kaiser, of course, from Durham, North Carolina, who was the highest, I found out later, the highest paid band leader, if you will. He didn't play anything, but he was in charge to during the whole era. Glenn Miller would get furious at the thought of that Kay Kaiser made more money than he did. Mm-hmm. And so did Harry James and so did others.
But you talked about that. That music was big. It was sweeping the country. But the glamorous players, I mean, they were all horn players, right? The trombone players.
That's right.
The sax.
Honestly, there were guys on the radio. You'd hear little bits and pieces. And there were a couple of disc jockeys in New York who were very broad in their tastes, who played, there was one called Fred Robbins, who played everything from Bessie Smith and King Oliver right from the start to the Dernier Cri, the latest thing, the first Errol Garner record that was made, the first bebop records that was, you know, starting to be made. And so I listened to that, and I didn't get the idea. I didn't really understand that this music had phases, eras, historically, that it was divided into there was the 20s, the 30s, yeah, the swing era, then there was this, and there was the time of New Orleans before the, you know, before the 20th century, and so forth and so on. But he played all those records. You could listen to whatever you wanted to, and right along with this, Am I going on too long?
No.
Right along with this was the a record ban instituted by the American Federation of Musicians, of which I'm still a member.
Right.
You don't have to be anymore, but you used to have to be then. And they had in the middle of 1942, they put a ban on any new records being made because the producers of the records weren't paying enough money to the people who made the records. I mean, here Glenn Miller made this rip-off record In the Mood, which was ba-ba-doop-a-doop-a-doop-a-doop-a-doop-a-doop. That idea had been used. He was even sued by Wingy Minone, a New Orleans trumpet player, mm-hmm, who'd made a record 20 years earlier or 15 years earlier of the same. It was just a blues thing. A lick they played on the blues. Anyway, and so there was this record band that this, you know, he had they had these colossal hits, right, String of Pearls and everything. And the guys go in the studio and get they don't get anything for it. They get $30 for 4 hours and goodbye.
Yeah.
And so he said, you know, we got to. He said we got to get a pension thing going here. We got to get these guys paid something, you know,
and some kind of royalties for
royalties. Something, you know.
Would you play something for us now?
Should I play the royalty and pension song?
The royalty and pension song. The one.
All right. I'll see you. An ancient song. Most of my songs are ancient, because I don't do any rock things or any of the sort of stuff that's been done in the last, probably written in the last 30, 40 years. I'm too old. I don't relate to it. And when I do, when guys my age do that kind of stuff, it's viewed at best with a kind of a benevolent disdain, mm-hmm, by others. You know, it's hey, Grandpa, do you, you know... it's terrible.
Yeah.
You don't because with most music, pop music, a whole aura, stage business goes with the costume,
right,
the attitude, the everything. You know, and I was around when the rock, and we used to have to play these sort of dopey rock songs. You know, Watermelon Man and things like that, and you know, I did all. We were already middle. I'm only in my 40s or 50s or whatever it is, and playing that stuff. Nobody was convinced.
Yeah.
Nobody.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's a problem. I mean, when us old guys try to look hip, you know.
Exactly.
So I'm down with that, Joe.
Yeah.
That's hip lingo.
Okay.
The kids use it all the time.
This ancient song. Take me to that land of jazz. Let me hear the kind of blues that Memphis has. I want to step to a tune that's full of ginger and pep. Pick 'em up, lay 'em down. Let me hear that razzmatazz. I want to give you fair warning. I won't be home before morning, no. Everybody loves a jazz bow in that loving land of jazz, oh, in that loving land of jazz. Let me hear the kind of blues that Greenwich, Connecticut has. I want to step to a tune that's full of ginger and pep. Oh, pick them up, Muffy. Lay them down, Binky. Let me hear that razzmatazz. What, you can't do it? Having your racket restrung? Oh, of course, that takes precedent, yeah. Oh, happy morning. Everybody loves a jazz bow. In that loving land of jazz. In that loving land of jazz. Oh, in that loving land of jazz. In that loving land of. In that loving land of jazz.
Marty Groves here in the Triangle at the invitation of Duke University, here on the State of Things at our invitation, and so happy to have you here.
Thank you.
What a great sound, and the Greenwich, Connecticut stuff is great. Now, I have made several failed attempts to learn the guitar, and I've even taken a lesson or two. And the one thing I will that I took away from that lesson, watching you play, is that you are holding it all wrong.
Oh, wow.
Which is to say, and you're, of course, you're a brilliant guitarist. You've taught yourself, though. You are self-taught. Right?
Yes,
I mean, you kind of hold it a little bit.
I had tips from guys. Yeah. You know, I watched guys naturally. Everybody, I'd go to see every big band I could see to see what the hell the guitar player was doing, and to listen to the other good sounds. I mean, I saw Basie when I was 11. My uncle took me to see it. But that was before I really knew what jazz was all about, or what they didn't call it jazz. They called it swing in those days, and. And then I'd go when I was like a teenager, you know, when I was 14, 12, 13, 15, I'd go to any place I could go to hear a band. And I was going to a boarding school in Massachusetts. I got kicked out. So it's that's good for my credentials.
Hang on. For what? What'd you do, Marty?
I was on probation for discipline. And you're not allowed to leave the school campus. And I went into Boston. I violated my probation and went in to see. I'd go to see any band they could. And I remember it was Charlie Spivak and his orchestra. He was a trumpet player, not really a hot player. And he had a band. And I went to see. I just went to see every. I didn't know. I was saying to myself, how come this guy stops playing and that guy starts playing? And I was like. I had no clue to how this all worked. And Jesus, this guy's playing, and all of a sudden it stops, and the drummer does eight bars. Although I didn't even know, I had the brains to count up bars, you know. And so I watched them, and then I would get books on guitar, and I used to play the guitar with my right foot propped up on a telephone book, like this.
Yeah,
And of course, we had in this boarding school of about 400 kids. There are about 11 of us. All the kids, of course, knew Bunny Berrigan's "I Can't Get Started." That was the anthem of all of them in those days. It was during the war, and all the kids knew Glenn Miller this and Benny Goodman that, and various hip things that all the other kids do. But very few were interested in small group jazz or in the history of jazz. Well, this record ban, the RCA Victor and Columbia and the big company, Decca, they started reissuing stuff that I – and so I didn't know any better. I got a Duke Ellington album. I said, okay, great. And it had Duke Ellington from the 40s as well as Duke Ellington in the late 20s in it. It had like Black and Tan Fantasy from the 20s. It had East St. Louis Toodaloo, you know, with a bowed bass and banjo and stuff, you know, wah, 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 wah.
Did you start noticing, because you said at the time when you started there was no sense of the decades of jazz. Did you begin to notice the difference in the sounds from era to era?
I really didn't know what it was, sort of a mishmash in my mind. I really didn't know that it was that those things were 100% over or were considered passé. Jazz, like rock music, moved very fast. Mm-hmm. By 1940, if you'd been a name in 1930, by 1940 you were an old timer. Yeah. Even though you were 30 years old, you were an old timer. You know.
And you're entirely self-taught, right?
Yes, I was.
Did you learn to read music, or you play all by ear?
I gradually learned. I'm not a great sight reader, but I gradually learned to sort of spell, as they call it, and, you know, I could figure out what was happening. And then I got a little just practice.
Yeah.
Practice makes you – and you ask people, you say, geez, how does this go? And the guy goes, beep, bop, boop, bop, boop, beep, 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 beep. It's nice. Some decent, friendly leaders will play this over for you a few times until you get it, you know.
Could you hear the guitar work in those big band sounds and swing bands? I mean, the guitar is pretty far in the background except for the solo. Were you just picking up the solos, or
could
you hear them all the way through?
I wanted to be a rhythm guitar player.
Wow.
Believe it or not, I heard Alan Roos on the Benny Goodman records. He was a wonderful guitar player, and I heard when I heard the Basie band and the Goodman band later on had a actually in 1945, 46, I heard that band, and they had a guy playing acoustic rhythm guitar, Mike Bryan, who also made some records at the same time with a small group where he played electric. But with the band, Goodman wanted straight rhythm guitar in those days for most of his career.
When was your first paid gig? Who were you working with?
I think my first professional gig, if you want to call it that, was for Room and Board in Southampton, Long Island, which was a Pashipoo resort town for the wealthy. And we had a four of us, and we had a trumpet player who could sell hell to a bishop. And he went out there and somehow convinced this owner, a Greek guy who owned a restaurant called The Windmill, which is basically a coffee shop with booze. And he convinced him to use our quartet, and we played for Room and Board.
Wow.
And we figured, being stupid, just gotten out of high school, stupid, devil-may-care, callow youths, we...
you were all those things, devil-may-care and callow.
It wasn't easy. and we got paid. We thought, well, we'd go around. There's all these rich people live there, and we can mow the lawns for them and do stuff like that. Of course, it was a pipe dream. I made a little extra money doing cartooning for a sign painter. It wasn't a very good sign painter. And my friends mentioned that I did cartoons. Oh, yeah, is he any good? And next thing you know, I was you know, when there was a turkey shoot at the VFW or whatever it was, I would draw a pilgrim with a blunderbuss and a turkey.
Well, I tell you what, your father, too, was an artist. We want to talk about that. I'm coming up against a break. So I'll continue my conversation with jazz guitarist Marty Gross right after this. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow, talking this hour with Marty Gross, jazz rhythm guitarist and raconteur. Marty, your father was a pretty well-known artist, George Gross. You were born in Berlin, right?
That's right.
And your father was a German artist. You came here when you were about 3 years old.
Exactly.
Tell us a little bit about your father and his work. Did you ever consider art?
Yes, I did. He taught it. He in 1932, he'd been tried. This is before Hitler. He'd been tried by the German government three times for blasphemy, lèse majesté, offenses against the public morals by his pictures he drew.
What was it about them that offended the Reich?
In a folio that was published called Ecce Homo, Behold the Man, from the Bible. That's a quote for those of you who are non-biblical students. Mm-hmm. And I suppose they're very – all of you are intensely into the Bible. I can see that by the serious looks on your faces.
Pontius Pilate, by the way. Go ahead.
That's it. There were some drawings in there that were offensive to the public morals. A teenage girl naked, being eyed by her uncle – you know, and all this kind of hear about all the day, but you didn't in those days.
Did he consider himself political?
Certainly, early in his life, yes, he did. He wrote for many left wing communist publications in Berlin, and you were either left or you were right. There wasn't much middle ground in Germany in those days. And then he actually took a sailboat ride from someplace in Germany on the North Sea to Finland with another guy, and they were sent to be the representatives of the German Communist Party, German art representatives of the Communist Party to Russia, and they took the sailboat and got their way to Leningrad. I never knew this. He never told me this in his lifetime. But he actually had an interview with Lenin, and he went around and so he was involved in politics. He quit the Communist Party early on. He told me, I've heard different versions, but he didn't discuss this much with his family, with my brother and myself. I had an older brother with us. But later on, he told me he couldn't idealize the common worker. They expected the common worker to always be well. You know, they always showed them in those propaganda things. Right. There they were, the worker with a sledgehammer over one arm and some kind of a cogwheel in the left hand, standing there, waist stripped to the waist, muscular, good looking, and the woman with a baby at her breast and a sheaf of wheat in the other hand, you know, all that kind. And he says, I can't buy it. He says, look, the workers are getting shafted. They have a tough lot that needs to be corrected, but that doesn't make them saints. Workers beat their wives too, and workers do dumb things, you know, and get drunk and punch each other out and do all the crazy things that the rest of society does. They're not angels, you know.
Did he pursue his artwork then when he came here?
He got a telegram. I'll try to make it brief. In 1932, he got a telegram from America, from the Art Students League. And, of course, like many German intellectuals or French or English or any European intellectual, many of them were crazy about the United States. He was crazy about America. He had an Indian costume that he would wear. They were nuts about cowboys and Indians. They romanticized this. It was, you know, and so he got a telegram to go to teach at the Art Students League at New York. They had had a revolution at the students didn't want to do the old stuff anymore. They wanted art that was au courant, hip, politically important, you know. And so they voted and they picked him, and he was over the moon. America, and they're going to pay me yet? You know, bing. And he went over, and then he brought my mother over. This was in 1932, and we stayed in Germany, my brother, older brother and I. And then my mother came back and got us. Oh, he came back just before Hitler took power in the winter of 1932 and packed up everything. Good thing he did. He was a pack rat. He kept everything, sent everything over to the States. And he had intended to. He said, "I'm going to live in the United States. I'm going to become an American citizen," which he did.
How did he feel about your career, your choice to become a musician?
He loved jazz. Yeah. And I used to come up to my room. I'm like, you know, 13, 14 years old. What is it? He'd come up to my room with a hat, with a bottle of Gallo, El Cheapo Gallo wine, and he'd say, have a glass of wine here. Apartment. He smoked these little cigarillos, and then he said, "Play me some records." And I played him stuff, you know, Ellington, Armstrong, all that stuff, you know, and he loved it. I'll play it again. Maybe play the thing over again, you know. And then he'd say, "Pick up your." I was fiddling around with the guitar. Pick up guitar and play along with it, and it really moved him. Oh. Sometimes tears came to his eyes.
Marty, we are all out of Gallo, but I wonder if I could prevail on you to play a song.
A quickie, sure. I do this. This is for Carson. He's been whistling and humming this damn thing since I played it yesterday or something. I don't know when it is. So.
Jealousy when they see you out with me. You're much sweeter, goodness knows. Honeysuckle rose, yeah, yeah, yeah. When I'm taking sips from your tasty lips, how the honey fairly drips. Your confection, goodness knows. Honeysuckle rose. Don't buy sugar, you just have to touch my cup. You're my sugar, and it's sweet when you stir it up. Oh, when I'm taking sips from your lips, how the honey fairly drips and oozes. Oh, you're much sweeter, goodness knows. Talking about honeysuckle rose. Touch my cup, you're my sugar, and it's sweet when you stir it up. Oh, when I'm taking sips from your tasty lips, how the honey fairly drips. You're much sweeter, goodness knows. Oh, talking about honeysuckle rose, talking about honeysuckle rose, talking about honeysuckle Rose.
Marty Gross live on the State of Things. He's going to be speaking at the Lilly Library at Duke University today at 4 o'clock about his father, painter George Gross. Tomorrow, Marty's going to perform at a concert at Lilly Library at 4 o'clock, but right here he is with us. That was great, Marty. And you're playing solo for us, but you played with a lot of big bands. How do you like that? I mean, how do you like playing with bigger groups? Or do you have a preference?
I like playing with small groups.
Yeah,
I played with some big groups, rehearsal groups. Five trumpets. Yeah. You know, that's just to keep your chops up and to help with the reading, you know, and stuff like that. But they all it was past the big band era, and most of these guys had all played in the studios, and it was like a fun thing with them. And they didn't really rehearse. They didn't really get the nuances down. Bands got to play softly as well as loud, you know. These guys were all kind of show the middle-aged cats trying to show that they got chops, you know.
Well, I want to give everybody a sense of what it sounds like when you're playing with a bigger group. This is Marty Gross and his Hot Puppies, and the song is China Boy. Gross and his Hot Puppies, China Boy. You remember that?
No.
When it's tough to, I can't imagine when I watch those bands play and I listen, I'm trying to figure out how everybody keeps their place and knows, you know, and they come right in on those solos and go right out. And it's, you got to be listening to everybody, right?
Sometimes it does. They don't come out right. But yeah, I know it is. You have to basically, as Louis Armstrong said, the band, he had made a wonderful statement, says there's two bands. There's one band that you have in your head, and then there's the band you play with.
Mm.
And he says, once in a while, but very rarely, the band in your head and the band you're playing with are the same. And he said, then it's heaven. And I don't know if this is the band that was in my head or that I was playing with, but obviously we were having a good time. Yeah, basically time is everybody has time.
Yeah.
Everybody in the band, when for example, Benny Goodman rehearsed his band, the sections, the trumpets and the brass and stuff and the saxes would rehearse without a rhythm section. They were supposed to, and good horn players like Louis Armstrong, for example, or Roy Eldridge. I could think of him. He was a drummer first before he was a trumpet player and stuff like that. They really can play without a rhythm section.
Wow.
But they did it. They play like that, and they always come out right, and it always works because they've been, you know.
Well, they've been playing together.
It's a philosophy.
All the improvisation then happens in the solos, right? You don't want people improvising while they're all playing together, or do you?
Sometimes that can be very. I love ensemble, the ensemble playing they had in the 20s and 30s and stuff. Some of those guys were geniuses. When you get four horns playing and they don't step on each other's parts, that's not that easy to do.
Right.
And there were certain guys who could do it very well indeed.
You knew Greensboro great Tal Farlow. He's from Greensboro. The octopus, they called him.
He certainly was. He had these huge hands. And you know, he had a guitar made for him with a shorter neck. A Gibson, when he hit the big time, and it was be like 19, end of the 40s, in early 50s, Gibson actually came out with a guitar, and he had these huge hands, and he had designed a guitar with a shorter fingerboard.
Wow, that sounds like really cheating, man. Bigger hands and smaller space to cover. And he did some strange things, didn't he? I mean, that was with the way he made chords, in a sense.
Yes.
I mean, probably because of those big hands.
Well, he to me, you know, of course, he looked like a big country boy, and then I've seen other guys do that, but not many because you're technically not supposed to use your thumb on the fingerboard.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's what self-taught guys always do. They grab, you know, and he used his thumb all the time, you know, played three or four chords, you know, folk music style or Western style. No, he was a monster, you know.
You were performing and talking on the Duke campus and UNC this weekend, I guess all this week. What do you tell the latest generation of jazz musicians?
Marry an heiress, or you know, that's not original with me. But you know, there's always that thing. How do you make a jazz musicians make a living? They get money from home. They marry a rich woman, what's the other one? You have a wife that works. Of course, that's necessary too.
Right.
You know.
Yeah. What do you call a jazz musician without a girlfriend? Homeless. You can take that one with you. You optimistic about jazz? You happy with the way it's going? The direction?
I'm absolutely pessimistic about it. Jazz music was dance music. The best, the most fun I ever had playing was playing for dancing. Yeah. That's because you don't have to hit home runs. When you're on stage, you always have to hit home runs. The drummer's got to do his things. He's got to disembowel himself. The bass player's got to, you know, and you got to do all this. The trumpeter's got to get higher and higher and higher, you know, and all that stuff, which is like weightlifting contest or something like that, you know. No, I think the jazz was at its best when it was played for dancing. That kind of gave it a sense of purpose and discipline, and took away from this self-conscious. Watch what I do with these chords, you know, and stuff. And I think it was much more flowing and natural then. And I don't know. I see there is not much chance for live music except what happens to be the latest rock thing.
Well, Marty, I got to tell you, you need to stick around a few more weeks in this area. You'll hear a lot of live jazz just up the street and other places. But I will tell you, it's a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you.
And listen to you. What a great pleasure. Thank Marty you. Gross, speak at Lilly Library at Duke University today at 4 about his father, painter George Gross. Tomorrow, Marty's going to perform a concert at Lilly Library at 4 o'clock. For information, visit library.duke.edu. Both events free and open to the public, as is our program, The State of Things, and our website, stateofthings.org, all free to the people. Go see it. Continue to listen to North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.